Hey, future doctors. Welcome back to Spoonful of Sugar. We have an amazing episode in store for you today on a much-needed topic. Let's let the host introduce themselves and take it away.
Hey, future doctors. Thanks for tuning in to Spoonful of Sugar, a podcast made for medical students by medical students to help the medicine go down. My name is Lexi Siri. I'm a fourth-year medical student at Drexel University College of Medicine, planning on going into internal medicine, and I will be your host today. I was born and raised in northeastern Pennsylvania in the town of Nanticoke, and if you know where that is, you're probably my mom. Hi, Mom. I mention this because northeastern Pennsylvania, and most of Pennsylvania in general, happens to be quite a hot spot for ticks. And it just so happens that today's episode, Tick Talk, we are going to be covering the basics of some common tick-borne illnesses that you may encounter both clinically and in your board exams. Now, ticks can be pretty nasty little creatures. They can be extremely small, just a few millimeters in diameter, which can make them really difficult to spot. They're usually most active from March to November and can be found in areas with thick foliage like forests, parks, gardens, etc. They prefer warm and damp areas both when living in the wild and when they decide to latch onto their prey. On humans, they tend to bite areas of the body that are warm and damp, as well as places that have hair. So make sure to examine skin folds behind the ears, between the fingers and toes, in the armpits, in the groin area, under breast tissue, and around the scalp. Tick bites really do not hurt. In fact, most people don't even know they have one on them until they spot the creature itself. If the tick is never spotted, it will fall off on its own once it is full and done feeding. While the process of being bitten by a tick doesn't sound like it can do much damage, it's the transfer of pathogens from the tick to the human that we have to worry about. And ticks can carry some pretty nasty diseases. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So, for each disease, I'm going to open by reading you a vignette. I'll give you a few moments at the end to think about what pathogen may fit this scenario, and then we'll dive into discussion about the disease. Let's begin. Vignette 1. A 23-year-old woman from Connecticut presents to the office with fevers, chills, body aches, and fatigue off and on for 1 week. She has no respiratory or GI symptoms. She has not had any recent sick contacts. She enjoys hiking and spending time outdoors with her dog. She does not report seeing any rashes on her body, but on physical exam you note a bullseye lesion on her back right at the waistband line. Labs are unrevealing aside from a mildly elevated ESR. What is her likely diagnosis? So the answer here is Lyme disease. So let's talk about Lyme disease first. It's probably the most well-known tick-borne illness. It's caused by the spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi, which gets transmitted by the deer tick, also known as Exoides scapularis. It's endemic to the United States, specifically the northeastern, mid-Atlantic, and the upper midwestern states. There are three different phases of the disease. The first phase is early localized disease, which can happen up to 1 month after the bite. The infection is localized to the bite site on the body at this point. In this stage, you'll want to look for that classic bullseye rash. This is your key to diagnosis in both a clinical setting and if you see it mentioned on exams. The rash will be at the site the tick was attached to and typically appears 7 to 14 days after the bite. The rash is also known as erythema migrans and is present in the vast majority of Lyme infections. However, whether the person is aware of the rash is a different story. Many people may miss the rash or do not even know they were bitten by a tick. This is where you, as their physician, doing a thorough skin exam can pay off. If you catch the rash early, the central clearing may not be present yet, so you may just see a warm red circle on the skin that will later develop into the classic targetoid lesion. Keep in mind that the rash may present differently on individuals with darker skin. The redness may appear fainter, and you actually may just see areas of darker skin pigmentation, but it should still appear in that classic targetoid pattern. Other symptoms people experience at this point are nonspecific, so just be on the lookout for signs of viral prodrome, including low-grade fevers, body aches, chills, fatigue, etc. The second stage of Lyme disease is early disseminated disease, which happens weeks to several months after the bite. This occurs when early localized disease goes untreated. The three big systems that are affected here are the neurologic, cardiovascular, and dermatologic systems. The most common neurological manifestations of the disease include Bell's palsy, peripheral neuropathy, optic neuritis, radiculopathies, and meningitis-like symptoms. Bell's palsy is a commonly encountered complication of Lyme. If you see a patient with new-onset Bell's with the risk factors for a tick bite, definitely think about testing for Lyme. In the cardiovascular system, AV block is the most common manifestation. If you see a patient with new AV block, you should definitely be thinking about Lyme as well. Sometimes you can see myocarditis. On the skin, you could see multiple erythema migrans, which is really just a bunch of those bullseye lesions spread all over the body. And keep in mind, this is due to dissemination of the spirochetes and not due to multiple tick bites. The third stage is late disseminated disease, which can happen months to years after the bite. These are the late manifestations of Lyme disease that has gone untreated. The most commonly encountered symptom here is arthritis. Classically, you'll see a patient with intermittent or persistent arthritis in a few different large joints in the body. Knees are very commonly impacted here. You may also see someone with neurologic symptoms as well. Mononeuropathy multiplex is a type of peripheral neuropathy that can result from untreated Lyme. So the diagnosis of Lyme disease can be tricky. When a patient presents early with only the erythema migrans rash, the diagnosis should be made clinically by observation alone. These patients have early localized disease, so there's a high probability that their serological results will be negative. For early disseminated or late disease, serologic testing is warranted, as well as testing for antibodies to Lyme itself. There are special considerations for people who are reinfected with Lyme, but that is outside of the scope of this talk. Additionally, you may see other nonspecific laboratory abnormalities like an elevated ESR or a mild leukocytosis early on in the disease, which is nonspecific, but it could help to support your clinical decisions. The gold standard treatment for Lyme is doxycycline. The course length is dependent on what stage the patient is identified to have. For young children, amoxicillin can be used since tetracyclines can have some negative consequences in young kids. Remember, the Yarish-Herxheimer reaction may occur after the patient begins taking doxycycline. The reaction happens because the antibiotics destroy the spirochetes and cause a large release of endotoxins and other inflammatory substances. Your patient may experience a sudden increase in body temperature, chills, rigors, headaches, body aches, tachycardia, and mild hypotension. These symptoms typically last a few hours and will resolve on their own. The patient should continue their antibiotics and can mitigate the uncomfortable symptoms with acetaminophen or ibuprofen. All right, so that's the 101 on Lyme disease. Let's move on to our next vignette. A 58-year-old man from eastern upstate New York with a past medical history notable for hypertension and moderate persistent asthma comes to the ED complaining of fever and fatigue for the past week. Yesterday, his urine became dark brown, and he noticed himself becoming short of breath easily with little exertion. He often takes his dogs for walks and lives in a highly wooded area. He recalls removing a tick from himself about 2 to 3 weeks ago. His medications include an ACE inhibitor and an inhaled corticosteroid. On physical exam, you note he appears slightly jaundiced with mild scleral icterus. You do not see any rashes on his skin, and his pulmonary exam is normal. His labs reveal anemia, thrombocytopenia, and elevated bilirubin. What is the likely diagnosis? The diagnosis here is babesiosis. So, let's talk more about babesiosis. This disease is caused by a protozoan from the Babesia species. This is also spread by the deer tick, or Ixoides scapularis. It is endemic to Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, but can often be seen all throughout the northeastern and northern Midwest of the United States. The protozoa infect red blood cells specifically, which leads to eventual lysis of the cells. The more lysed red blood cells there are, the more symptomatic the patient becomes. In mild to moderate disease, you'll see a gradual onset of fatigue and malaise with intermittent fevers, plus or minus chills, sweats, and myalgias. You might note mild hepatosplenomegaly on physical exam, but you will not see any rashes in this disease. If you do see a rash, be suspicious for concurrent infection with another tick-borne illness like Lyme. Severe disease tends to be more common in people over 50, people with splenectomies, malignancies, HIV, and those who take immunosuppressive drugs. Our guy in the vignette is 58 and he takes chronic steroids, so he has two of the risk factors for severe disease. With severe disease, you'll see many of the symptoms you see in mild to moderate disease, just on a more intense level. You may also see things like pulmonary edema, splenic infarcts, or even splenic rupture in very severe cases. Up to half of people hospitalized with babesiosis develop complications including renal failure, respiratory failure, acute congestive heart failure, shock, disseminated intravascular coagulation, and delirium. Complications are highly associated with a severe anemia that results from the lysis of red blood cells. Diagnosis can be made by identification of Babesia protozoa on blood smears. On the smears, you could see the Babesia trophozoites, which are round or oval-shaped and have a blue cytoplasm. You can see one or multiple of these ringed organisms in one red blood cell. So the pathognomonic finding here is seeing merozoites arranged in a tetrad formation, or you may know it as the Maltese cross formation. Clinically, it is rare to observe this pattern, but if you see this buzzword in a question stem on an exam, think of Babesia. Other lab values consistent with babesiosis include low hematocrit and hemoglobin, low haptoglobin, elevated lactate dehydrogenase, reactive reticulocytosis with thrombocytopenia, possible elevation in liver enzymes, increased total and indirect bilirubin, BUN, and creatinine. Azithromycin and etobicoke are the antimicrobials of choice for treatment, and duration depends on the severity of the disease. You may have noticed that a lot of the signs, symptoms, and complications of babesiosis are pretty similar to malaria. When given a clinical scenario, it is important to pay close attention to the risk factors the person has. Like if they travel to areas where malaria is endemic, think Africa, Asia, South America, versus areas where babesia is endemic, think the northeastern United States. If the question writers are nice, they'll give you that. They might also give you the blood smear results. If you see the words Maltese cross, think babesia immediately. All right, we're on a roll. Let's move on to vignette number 3. A 36-year-old woman who works as a park ranger in the southeastern United States presents to the emergency department with a 5-day history of fevers, intense headaches, and a rash. The rash began on her wrists and her ankles and then spread centrally to her chest and abdomen. She notes severe body aches as well. She is currently febrile at 102.5 degrees Fahrenheit. On physical exam, you note a petechial rash on the wrists, ankles, forearms, legs, and trunk of the patient. The rest of the exam is unrevealing. Labs show thrombocytopenia. What is the likely diagnosis? The diagnosis here is Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever is caused by Rickettsia rickettsii, which is a gram-negative obligate intracellular bacteria. It prefers to invade vascular endothelial cells, which leads to direct vascular injury of the organism it is infecting. It is carried by the American dog tick, or Dermacentor variabilis, in the United States. It is endemic to the southeastern states and the south central states. Early identification of Rocky Mountain is vital because this illness can carry up to a 20 to 30% mortality rate in patients who do not receive treatment. In the early stages of the disease, most patients have nonspecific symptoms such as fever, headache, malaise. Nausea is often a common complaint as well. The rash that occurs in Rocky Mountain is really the key feature in clinical diagnosis. Rash occurs in up to 90% of cases and develops around the 3rd to 5th day of illness. It can be described as a blanching, erythematous macular rash that becomes petechial over time. In plainer terms, it's a splotchy, pinpoint-looking red rash. It characteristically begins on the hands and feet and spreads centrally to the trunk. Palm and sole involvement are also common, but occur later in the illness course. But seeing palm and sole involvement really helps you to narrow down your diagnosis because there's a smaller amount of pathogens that cause this involvement, and Rocky Mountain is one of them. Another reminder to examine the skin closely on individuals with dark skin, as the redness may be less prominent. You'll still see that splotchy pinpoint appearance of the rash, but you may see darker pigmentation instead of redness. Other physical exam findings can include abdominal pain, cough, and pedal edema. If the disease progresses, more serious findings can include encephalitis, pulmonary edema, adult respiratory distress syndrome, cardiac arrhythmias, coagulopathies, gastrointestinal bleeding, and skin necrosis. Meningitis-like symptoms may be present if the nervous system is involved. Later on, you may see abnormal mentation, seizures, and focal neurological deficits. Laboratory abnormalities are nonspecific, but you may see thrombocytopenia. In more severe cases, hyponatremia, elevated liver enzymes, elevated bilirubin, and coagulation abnormalities may be seen. Since the patient will likely present with fevers, headaches, and a petechial rash, it is absolutely appropriate to consider meningitis, since that is a potentially rapidly fatal infection. The results of the lumbar puncture will help you to differentiate between meningitis and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. If it is Rocky Mountain, you'll see a moderately elevated protein with normal glucose as opposed to bacterial meningitis, where you would expect to see low glucose. To definitively diagnose Rocky Mountain, you need to do serology. However, these tests may be negative if the patient is experiencing the early stages of the disease. Treatment should be started immediately when Rocky Mountain is suspected, because delays in treatment are associated with an increased mortality rate. Doxycycline is the preferred agent of treatment, and the duration is dependent on the extent of the disease. For completeness' sake, I just want to touch briefly on ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis. Ehrlichiae and anaplasma are both obligate intracellular bacteria that grow in membrane-bound vacuoles inside of human leukocytes. Ehrlichiosis, or human monocyte ehrlichiosis, as it is also known, is endemic to the southeastern, south central, and mid-Atlantic states of the United States. It is carried and spread by the Lone Star tick, or Amblyomma americanum. Anaplasmosis, or human granulocyte anaplasmosis, is endemic to the northeastern states and is carried and spread by the deer tick Exoides scapularis. Overall, you'll see patients come in with nonspecific symptoms like the classic fever, malaise, myalgias we've talked about. Rashes in these two illnesses are very uncommon, so if you see one, you may want to think about Rocky Mountain or Lyme. Your most important piece here for diagnosis is going to be the history that you get from the patient, where they live, if they spend time outside, if they've traveled to endemic regions. A common laboratory finding here is leukopenia, from the direct destruction of the leukocytes. Diagnosis is clinically made and can be confirmed with serology. Treatment for both is with the good old doxycycline. So, let's wrap this up and put it in a bow. Remember, for all tick-borne illnesses, assess the risk factors the patient has. Do they live in an endemic area? Have they traveled to one? Do they spend a lot of time outdoors, in wooded areas, or in areas with tall grass? Do they have pets that like to roam outside? For Lyme disease, remember erythema migrans or the bullseye rash. Also remember to think about Lyme in someone who has developed otherwise unexplained Bell's palsy, AV block, or multi-joint arthritis. Don't forget that patients can experience the Jarisch-Herxheimer reaction after beginning doxycycline treatment due to the endotoxin released from the spirochetes. For Babesia, remember this tick-borne illness closely mirrors malaria. You may see jaundice, anemia, hepatosplenomegaly, and hematuria due to the lysis of red blood cells. Remember the buzzword here is Maltese cross pattern when you observe the protozoan on blood smears. Also remember, you will not see a rash with this illness. For Rocky Mountain spotted fever, remember the petechial rash that begins on the hands and feet and spreads centrally. Because of the extent of vascular endothelial damage, do not delay treatment if you suspect Rocky Mountain. Mortality rates can reach up to 30% if left untreated. Ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis are quite similar and are not as commonly tested on as the other three illnesses that we discussed. However, if you do have a suspicion for a tick-borne illness and see labs that show leukopenia, make sure to keep these two on your radar. Lastly, here are some tips from the CDC to keep yourself safe from ticks. Before going outside, treat your clothing and gear with products containing 0.5% permethrin. Make sure your pets are protected too with flea and tick treatments. Spray yourself with insect repellents containing DEET, D-E-E-T. When coming back inside, check your clothes. If you see a tick attached to your clothing, throw the garment in the dryer on high heat for 10 minutes. Low temperatures may not kill the ticks. Make sure to check your furry friends for ticks as well if you brought them along. And try to shower within 2 hours of coming home. Before hopping in, give yourself a good skin check, especially under the arms, in and around the ears, inside the belly button, behind the knees, around your waistband area, under the hair on your scalp, and in your groin area. If you ever do find yourself having a tick attached to you, the CDC has a cool little tool called Tick Bite Bot. You could log on to their website and use the bot, and it'll help to guide you step by step in removing the tick. Thank you so much for listening. If you found this episode helpful, please subscribe to our podcast. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org and post them under the link for this episode. Good luck with studying, and remember that if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is here to help the medicine go down.